please stay tuned to the end of this program or see the show notes for important information regarding today's speakers and the content of this podcast. Hello, everyone, and welcome to a special episode of Allergy Talk, a roundup of the latest in the field of allergy and immunology by the American College of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology. On February 16th, 2024, the FDA announced the approval of the first biologic to treat patients with food allergy, omalizumab. In this second part of a two-part series, we're going to discuss important considerations in implementing this new treatment in your practice. Well, hello, everyone. My name is Jerry Lee. I'm an associate professor at Emory University and an assistant editor of Allergy Watch. We are very fortunate today to be joined by two investigators in the ELMATCH trial, which led to this new FDA indication for food allergy. Our first guest is Dr. Sharon Chinthraja, an associate professor at Stanford University, where she is the director of the Sean N. Parker Center for Allergy and Asthma Research and a co-chair of the ELMATCH study. Sharon, thank you so much for joining us on Allergy Talk.
Thanks, Jerry. I'm excited to be here with you and Brian today. I'm Sharon Chinthraja. I'm an allergist, immunologist, and a pulmonary critical care doctor, and direct the Sean N. Parker Center at Stanford University.
And our second guest is Dr. Brian Vickery, the Marcus Professor of Pediatric Immunology and Division Chief at Emory University and Children's Healthcare of Atlanta. He was one of the site investigators of the ELMATCH study. Brian, thanks again for coming back to episode two.
Thanks, Jerry, for having me. I really look forward to the conversation. I want to thank Sharon for joining us as well. As you said, Sharon was a co-protocol chair and really a fearless leader on the ELMATCH study, but also, as was mentioned, runs the group at Stanford, which has really done a ton of work in treating multi-food allergic participants in previous studies and kind of helping to work this out clinically. A lot of experience with multi-food OIT and omalizumab and other biologics, frankly. And so Sharon has just a tremendous knowledge base that will help this discussion.
So Sharon, in the previous episode, I reached out to Bob and asked him to get his perspective and reflection about all the years of hard work and the COVID-19 and all the things you've got to this moment. The presentation on Sunday at the Academy had a standing ovation. Could just tell me how you're feeling and how's this month and week been for you?
This is an amazing achievement due to the hard work of so many people. As Brian mentioned, our team here at Stanford has done a lot of work in this space, which was really pioneered by thought leaders like Kari Nadeau, who thought about multi-allergen oral immunotherapy and omalizumab for multi-food allergic patients, amongst others in the field, Dale Ometsu, Hugh Sampson, Bob. And so this is something that started back in 2011 with the first studies. And so, you know, I had phase one patients reaching out to me saying, finally, this is approved. Look at the long road that it's taken to get here. And so it's been wonderful actually getting these little messages from patients in the community who have really been true advocates to move the field forward. Part of protocol discussions at each of our centers, right? Where we're trying to really make a protocol and a therapy that can make a difference in their lives. It's been a lot of buzz, very busy.
I mean, everyone I've talked to said this is just as big as the LEAP study, if not more, for especially for the food allergic patients. So we absolutely should dive into it. Ryan, just so we set the stage for implementation, what does the label actually say from the FDA on omalizumab?
So the label indication is very broad and basically says that omalizumab is indicated in patients who are allergic to one or more foods from the ages of one and above for the protection from allergic reactions occurring with accidental exposure, and that omalizumab is indicated for use with an ongoing allergen avoidance diet.
So for Pete's sake, that's like 8 to 10% of the population. So, I mean, I think we really need to think about, you know, patient selection, especially as we think about the best way to implement this drug. So Sharon, let's start with you. In your opinion, is there any patients you think particularly would benefit from omalizumab treatment?
Yes. I mean, I think every allergist is thinking about who benefits from this therapy and cost-benefit analysis as well, and reaching diverse patient populations. But I think clear patient profiles in my mind are patients who have had multiple reactions to the foods that they're allergic to, one or many foods, despite careful avoidance. I think this is a good therapy for those folks. I think if somebody has had a serious or life-threatening allergic reaction that's convincing to the allergist, that's an important person to protect with this therapy. Somebody who has other atopic conditions like asthma or eczema that might also benefit from this is a good candidate. And I'm curious, Brian, your thoughts too, because I think this will differ across all of our practices.
I think at present, the theme is that in some ways, this asks more questions than it answers. And we're really trying to think through this. And this concept of patient segmentation and appropriate patient selection is among the first questions that I think we're all struggling with to an extent. I agree with everything that Sharon said. I tend to think about this from a kind of a use case standpoint, with the alternative being avoidance or immunotherapy or some other kind of approach. What kind of use case would favor omalizumab monotherapy? And of course, at the end of the day, it's all going to come down to shared decision-making, right? And identifying what are the participants or the patient's goals? What is the family concerned about? What is the particular food? What is the history of reaction? And so on. We are hearing from patients, as Sharon said, and I've got a whole list of people, and I'm sure everybody does, who are 16, 17-year-olds that are thinking about going to college. And how am I going to manage through college? How am I going to manage through study abroad or travel or what have you? That's an example of a use case where this is a treatment that could be administered in the health clinic at the university every 2 or 4 weeks. They don't have to manage self-administration or adherence with a daily medication in between if they came to their appointment and got their injection or they didn't. So adherence can be verified, and it would offer them the kind of protection while they're obviously still being very careful about their exposure and carrying epinephrine. But up until now, we haven't had great solutions for patients like that. And we always know, we hear from patients that oftentimes these transitional periods in their lives create stress about how am I going to manage through that? Another one is entering the school system for young kids or transitioning to more independence for tweens and early teenagers. And so I think about it from a use case standpoint. People might not stay on it forever, but they may feel like there are periods in their life where they really could benefit from treatment. And particularly for those with multiple food allergies, you know, that's a really difficult thing to have wrestled with in the past. And this might be a good opportunity for people like that, in addition to other use cases that we'll probably talk about in the rest of the time.
So again, there's so many people who can benefit, but there's no doubt anybody with food allergy can hear about this treatment and are going to see consultation from us. And again, we're talking about 8 to 10% of the population. Well, Sharon, how should allergists and immunologists prepare right now, now that we know that this is on the horizon? Anything you would advise practices to do?
I think all of us have been thinking about how we're going to handle increased volume of patients interested in therapy. And the way we've been approaching it here at Stanford, Tina Sinder, who is a key person at managing food allergies, and Sean McGee here and Joseph Hernandez at the Stanford Allergy Clinic have really been thinking about how are we going to offer different therapeutic options, have these conversations, staff the clinics. And I think one way to really think about it is tiers of patients who are, I think we all have people in our wait lists just trying to get in for an evaluation. So a nurse or office person who can try and get key details so that providers can assess necessity and have first tier, second tier, third tier is one idea, but also gearing up for staffing and thinking about how are you going to accommodate these visits for initial consultations, observed injections, will that occur in a single patient room or a waiting room? How can we innovate in our clinical practice with digital tools, telemedicine? And how do we give information ahead of time so that we can have an informed conversation when that patient first comes in?
Brian, have you taken a particular approach at Children's Health Care Atlanta?
Well, it's validating to hear Sharon's thoughts there, again, at a place that has been doing this for a really long time. I think we're all to an extent, wrestling with how to respond to demand in a rapidly changing environment and realizing there are sort of like short, medium, and long-term steps. And so one of the first things that we wanted to do was to really work educating our clinical staff about this, to say, look, this is happening. You're currently familiar with the biologics process and even this medication Xolair, giving it for our patients that have asthma and hives, but now we're going to have food allergy patients who are going to get it, and here's why. And you're going to start to get inquiries from food allergy patients who have seen the news and are interested in whether or not this is a potentially appropriate treatment for their family, right? So one of our first goals was just to educate the staff that this is happening, you're going to hear about it, and then to develop some key messages first. So when somebody, we use Epic, right? So when somebody sends an in-basket message, there's a dot phrase that says, you know, we've received your message, we're aware of the approval with Xolair, and we're developing the capability to offer this to patients, and they respond with a few key messages about the treatment, what it does and doesn't do. But just to sort of acknowledge, we've received your message and we're working on this, and that we have developed a process for how we're going to deal with these requests. One of the other things we did is pretty quickly, we updated our website for the clinic so that we could refer people there. And there's some FAQs and some other information that we'll continue to update as we know more that we can drive people to as a central point of information. And then one of the early steps in the process that we've thought about as a group is to have that nurse look and see, when was the last time we have any serum IgE testing on file? Because as you know, the indication, although as potentially broad as it is, doesn't apply to every single patient. It applies to patients who have an in-range IgE level, and that's not going to be all food allergy patients. The highest your total IgE can be to qualify for this treatment is 1,850 units, which is a little bit higher than it is for asthma, but it's still not unlimited. And we have lots of atopic patients who have IgE levels higher than that. So we want to know what that is before we engage in this really extensive evaluation process and people get to feeling hopeful that this might be an option for them. And then it turns out, oh, actually, you know, you're not eligible because your level's too high. So sort of felt like that's a priority piece of information that we need to get if we don't have a recent one. And then we kick it to the providers for that sort of shared decision-making conversation. I'm thinking a lot of the same things that Sharon talked about with telemedicine and efficiency. I mean, I think one of the key challenges as a division director is we already have access challenges before. It's one thing to deal with existing, established, well-phenotyped patients that I take care of, that I know that this is a good candidate, and there's still going to be implications for scheduling and all these other things. But if patients that we don't know come to the center because they've heard about this and they want omalizumab now, well, they're going to have a new patient evaluation first. And that exacerbates our existing access problem. And that kind of makes my head hurt. But it's a good problem to have, I guess I could say, right? That's our job, is to figure that out.
So we've talked about shared decision-making several times. If someone's going to come in and say, is this treatment right for me? And the physician is very influential in the shared decision-making conversation about which way they go. I mean, what would be a critical element we should include if people are asking questions, if this is right for them? Sharon, what would you think we should absolutely be saying to our patients?
Well, a few things that are important are that this, we think, is a great therapy. We know the side effect profile. It's been a drug that's been out there for 20 years. Allergists have used this. I think allergists should be part of the conversation to whether this is going to be a treatment option for food allergy patients. I think that's really important. And that some people, it might not work, right? I think that is a really important piece. Everybody's so excited. There's a lot of media buzz about this. And right now we don't have a great tool to understand who it works really well in and who it doesn't work in. And those are a few people, 14%, but those are important people. So I think that's an important part of the conversation. And also to understand what are their goals. If you want protection from accidental exposure, this is a great drug. And we need to keep in touch and evaluate how this is working for you. That's another conversation about how allergists are going to use this in practice. And it only works if you take it, right? There is a possibility that you could use this for at-home use. And so I think compliance is an important piece of this, as it is with any therapy like oral immunotherapy. So the same types of conversations that we've had with our oral immunotherapy patients are important to have here in this conversation. It's a different type of therapy. Hopefully it's easier for some. It is still injections, but continued regular use is really important.
So Brian, earlier you were talking about the well-phenotyped patients that we know what they're allergic to or not. There are patients who just got panel tested or whatever, and they're coming in and they want to know if there's drugs for them. We could give them protection with omalizumab, but how strict should we be about delabeling some of these food allergies? There may be ones that are real, some that are questionable. How aggressive should we be in delabeling before starting the treatment?
I don't have a pithy answer that addresses all those cases, but I'll tell you, I'm really concerned about this, to be honest, because we know that our tests don't have high specificity, that patients are often misclassified or unnecessarily restricted, avoiding foods that they don't really need to avoid because they've been kind of exuberantly evaluated in the past. And we know that not enough challenges are routinely done in practice. So one of the things that we do when we evaluate kind of all patients, treatment aside, is to try to clarify exactly what their diagnosis is. And oftentimes that requires systematically doing multiple challenges. We do at our place 700 or 800 food challenges a year. That probably ranks well down the list among the busiest places doing food challenges. But you got to do that to really help people understand what they need to truly be careful about as you manage food allergy. And those challenges are often great sources of relief for patients. Even if there are foods that we wouldn't challenge them to, that we know they're allergic to, they're often have these broadly restrictive diets that we can really help them manage. And that makes their life easier, totally separate and apart from treatment. So when you start omalizumab, you compromise your ability to do that evaluation. They're going to react differently once they're on omalizumab. And that's a really important factor that we're going to need to take into account. For every peanut allergic patient who's avoiding all the tree nuts out of precaution because they were told to by somebody who tested them and they're sensitized to a couple of them, do we really need to do 11 tree nut challenges before we would start them on omalizumab? Is that practical? How are we going to handle that? I mean, it's a difficult problem, but I think this is something that is going to have to be addressed because, again, we have this, I'll call it like an overdiagnosis problem, and there's a potential for overtreatment or just sort of a obscuring of what the real condition is once omalizumab is on board. That's not an insurmountable problem. There's a lot of ways that we could really think about carefully addressing that. We need to develop better biomarkers. We could still do challenges, but this treatment is unique in that it's a multi-food treatment potentially. And this thorough phenotyping evaluation is part of working up those kinds of patients.
Brian sort of alluded to it, but Sharon, I'd love to just speak to this. We often do serial testing in our patients. We test for resolution. Someone could have reacted and they want to know, was that an allergic reaction? If you're on omalizumab, what do we know about our ability to evaluate these patients on the drug?
It's harder. That's what we know. We don't typically order IgE tests after they've been started because they can be falsely high. It really depends on the test. For specific IgEs as well, free IgE is not commercially available. And so that's going to be a very hard evaluation. Skin prick tests decrease over time. So you may still see some positivity, but the longer you use it, the smaller those skin prick tests get. And then obviously a food challenge threshold sensitivity will change. And so as Brian mentioned, I think we need other tests. And phenotyping is going to be really important, to Brian's point, before we start therapy to have a sense. This may not be a lifetime drug. This might be a moment in time for each individual. And I think that's part of the shared decision-making, determine how long it is going to be for each individual. And that will also influence if there's a burning question, whether we stop this drug. I don't anticipate that, but that's what we have at the moment.
Let's talk about the duration of the effect. Just a couple considerations for this. One is the best accurate testing, food challenges, skin, blood testing would be obviously when the drug washes out. And then there's the other question that came up earlier, gaps in therapy, prior authorization, you change insurances, non-adherence. Do we know how the duration of the protection, Brian, when would we be able to, number one, reevaluate a patient off the drug, or how long would the patient be vulnerable if there was a gap in therapy?
I think what we can say is that we know that 5 elimination half-lives of omalizumab is about 16 weeks. So from the time that they get their last dose, about 4 months later, you could expect that the drug's out of their system. Now, how does their reactivity change during that period of time? Is it shorter than that where we could make a clinical decision? I would actually defer to Sharon. I'd love to hear what she says. She may have more experience than me. I think it's like any drug, you're going to wash out and then you're going to be back to baseline and then you could do your evaluation. And for omalizumab, that's going to be at minimum 4 months. Sharon, would you add anything to that?
No, I think you're exactly right, Brian. And I think this is where there's so much work still to be done on the diagnosis and treatment front.
I think another question that's going to come up also is, again, what the OutMatch is stunning, which is OIT versus omalizumab or using it together. Some of that's data we're not going to get for a while, but that doesn't mean a lot of people are going to be asking about it or thinking about it. Is there any data or indication can we think about the use of omalizumab with OIT? Sharon, I was wondering if you could start with that.
There is a lot of phase 1, phase 2 data out there looking at omalizumab with either single allergen oral immunotherapy, peanut, milk, or multi-allergen oral immunotherapy, and even real-world experience of omalizumab used for asthma indication in patients who also have food allergy and changing threshold sensitivity there. And I think based on some of those protocols, some practices are already using it in combination therapy. Those are practices that I think already do a lot of oral immunotherapy. I think stage 2 is really exciting from the OutMatch study because it's comparing omalizumab alone with placebo oral immunotherapy compared to omalizumab start followed by multi-allergen oral immunotherapy. And I'm excited about combination approaches. This is kind of the art of medicine, where when we have more therapeutic choices, there's the art of combining it. So Brian, do you have other thoughts?
What I would say is you're absolutely right. There's been a bunch of studies and your name is on the author line for many of them. There's been a systematic review of meta-analysis that looked at this using these two in combination. There were 30 something studies from all over the place. So we got actually a lot of data about this and we'll learn more from OutMatch to come. But I think what OutMatch showed was that you get protection from omalizumab with OIT. We knew that already. That's been published before. What OutMatch showed is that you get protection from omalizumab alone, monotherapy. And so that's a big achievement, especially for the multi-food population who may or may not be an OIT candidate or what have you. But so what? So you can use monotherapy to desensitize people to multiple food allergens. Like, are they really going to do that forever? Are there going to be some patients, younger patients, staple food patients who are going to want to consume the food? Obviously, there are going to be lots of teenagers with treatment allergy who have no interest in OIT or consumption, but others might. And so how are we going to tackle that? I think there's going to be more and more that will come out about that. It is a bit the art of medicine, and it's going to come back down to that sort of shared decision-making conversation. But I do think the effect size that you get from omalizumab, the protection is so robust that being able to get small amounts into the diet is going to be possible for the people that want to do it. And there'll be more guidance that comes out about this over time. As Bob said in the previous discussion, that's not in the label. It won't ever be in the label. It'll be something that clinicians figure out how to do. And as Sharon said, some people are already doing it, but you know, more and more will come out about this.
Just overall, we've asked more questions today than answered, I think. But Sharon, just to help our community, is there anything else we should be considering when we're thinking about implementing omalizumab for our practice?
There's so many questions, like you said, Jerry. And to Brian's point, each individual patient is unique in their moment in time right now. And there's specific circumstances, social circumstances, as well as their allergy history. And I think this is really important in the full evaluation of a patient for a treatment option. I'm not saying anything that allergists don't know already, but food allergy is a family disease. It affects the entire family, and so do the therapies. And so I think that's really important when we try and assess what therapeutic approach is important for our food allergy patients, is to kind of get a sense of their social circumstances, the support that they have, and who's going to be there to help them be compliant and safe in their choices. And I think this is the wonderful relationship of an allergist and their patient, to build that trust so that we can really assess how safe is this approach for this individual? Are they going to be compliant? And talk about all of these different options of, are we going to combine this with other choices? And how do we do that safely? That's got to be with allergist knowledge, information, advice. So I think that's really an important piece here and an exciting piece, and everything that our allergists already know how to do.
So Brian, do you have anything else to add to that?
I agree with everything that Sharon just said, and I especially appreciate her consideration of family circumstances, the social circumstances, and considering the entire impact of food allergy on not just the patient, but the other family members. Because one of the things that I'm really interested in and increasingly focused on is, okay, so we've done the phase 3 trial. This drug has now been approved. It is now available for clinical use. But how do we ensure that we are improving outcomes for patients? That's the goal, is we're improving outcomes. And as you mentioned, there's a lot of questions that are still unanswered. And so this process does not stop here with the approval. There's a whole new set of research questions that need to be asked and answered related to cost effectiveness and patient selection, precision phenotyping questions, and the other implementation related outcomes as it pertains to quality. Are we able to keep people out of the emergency room? You know, prevention from hospital admission, these kinds of things. How do we know that this is working? Quality of life outcomes and the psychosocial considerations that Sharon brought up. And so there's much more that needs to be done. And for people that are interested in those kinds of questions and know how to address those kinds of what I'll call phase 4 real world observational clinical studies, we need people like that to really help us understand how do we move forward from where we are today to where we are in the future, knowing how better to use this to drive better outcomes. Because if we don't do that work, we'll still all be kind of scratching our heads and each making individual decisions in the best interests of our patients as we should. But we need to capitalize on these opportunities to really ask those questions. Okay, how do we measure quality outcomes in food allergy with this or any other intervention? And that's really where this field needs to go, because we haven't had the opportunity to ask those questions yet. We do in asthma, we do in rhinitis, other fields. Food allergy is just getting to the point where we now have multiple interventions available to patients. And this opens up a whole new avenue of investigation and study. And we've got to do those studies to make sure that we're choosing the right treatment for the right patient and achieving the outcome we want to. And we've got to have that in order to move this field forward to where we can talk to patients and their families about what kind of outcomes they can really expect.
No, that's a great point, Brian. And I think we're just continuing these conversations about not only making sure that we are providing access to treatments that our patients want, but they're actually better, that we're actually helping patients. And I look forward to all the studies that you and Sharon and Bob and everyone in the Food Allergy Research Committee will contribute. Well, this was an amazing conversation. I really appreciate everyone's time. If you really liked this podcast, please rate us on iTunes. This really helps us. And you may have a lot of questions. I know we ask a lot of questions on this podcast, but if you do have further questions about the use of omalizumab and the new FDA label, please send it to us. allergytalk1word@acaai.org is our email. And maybe we'll schedule another podcast later to discuss this. I appreciate everyone's attention. My name is Jerry Lee. Appreciate everyone who was the families, the patients, and also the study coordinators and investigators who participated in the study. Have a wonderful day. Today's speakers have the following disclosures. Dr. Lee has nothing to disclose. Dr. Chintharaja has consulted for Genentech and Novartis. Dr. Vickery has consulted for Genentech and Novartis.